With virtually limitless design options, Pella is like your personal barista for windows and doors. Customize your order by August 31st and you can bundle and save big at Pella Windows and Doors of Wisconsin. Get started today at PellaWI.com.
Live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios at The Avenue, it's the Jeff Wagner Show. Come join the conversation on the Old National Bank talk and text line at 855-616-1620. Old National Bank. Get old. Now, here's WTMJ's Jeff Wagner.
Good afternoon, Wisconsin. Welcome to the show. So very glad to have you with us. And once again, we remind people, for the last month or so, you have been able to not only listen to us, but you can watch us if you choose. We're available. We live stream all the broadcasts from our Avenue studios, and you can. We have our own WTMJ YouTube channel, and you can watch it there. Or easiest way is just to go to WTMJ.com and hit the watch live button, or you can certainly just the listen live button as well, and you can see, in my case, you can see how my wife has dressed me on any particular day. So you know, we're rocking that. I want to start off the program. This was... Allow me to be self-indulgent for just a moment. So I was off yesterday. There was an early Brewers game, so Steve Scafidi graciously agreed to do the last half hour of what would have been the half hour of my show. So I went to Chicago to, as I was saying, to see West Side Story. Absolutely tremendous show at the Lyric Opera if you get a chance to see it. So I come back and there is a package waiting for me that my producer Charlie has. He said, this came for you. And he, of course, hasn't opened it because – well, whenever you get these packages, you just never know. It can go any sorts of ways. So, you know, we don't want white powder falling out or something like that. So he gave it to me. I just bravely opened it. But this is the way we start my Friday, and you have made my day. Here's the letter. It's a handwritten letter. Hi, Jeff. My name is such and such. I live in Sheboygan. My claim to fame is that I am a charter member listener of the Department of Justice, which is what we used to call the program when I started here at WTMJ 25 years ago. That was the Department of Justice is open. That's how long you've been a part of my life. You're a wonderful radio personality, and all of us and tons of us in radio listening community not only enjoy your program, but depend on you to fill our day with such thoughtful discussions. Please keep talking to us, Jeff. We promise to keep listening. What a nice, nice letter. And then recently, the neighboring community of Howard's Grove had a citywide garage sale. As I was walking from house to house, I found this Jimmy Buffett magazine for sale. Now, he obviously knows I'm a huge Jimmy Buffett fan. Seeing it, I immediately thought of you, hoping you enjoy it. And this was a couple years ago, Life Magazine. And I'm going to put this up to show it to the camera. Life Magazine put up a Jimmy Buffett going strong in Margaritaville when he turned 75 years old, and a Life Magazine thing. And so the listener purchased it, you know, at a garage sale and sent it to me. So thank you very much. You have absolutely, completely, 100% made my day. How nice is that? Okay, we had just all you know what has broken loose over the course of the last day or so. We'll talk about the shared revenue deal and what this means for the state and my take on this, and we'll give you a chance to weigh in on one particular aspect of it. But of course, the breaking news from last night, and I was we'd come back from Chicago and we went out to dinner down along the lakefront with the couple that we'd gone to Chicago with, and all of a sudden my phone just kind of blows up, and I have a policy of when I'm at dinner, I think it's kind of rude to pull out your cell phone and look at it, but it just kept beeping and beeping and beeping. So finally, I reached in my pocket, I pulled it out, and I keep getting all these notices saying, okay, Donald Trump has been indicted in connection with the documents case. Now, as I said in the lead into this, take my advice as a former federal prosecutor. No matter how you spin it, it's never a good thing to find your name at the top of a federal indictment, you know, United States of America versus whatever. It's never a good thing, because the reality is that the U.S. Attorney's offices rarely fool around. The Department of Justice rarely fools around. As a former prosecutor, I will tell you this. You know, we would pick and choose our cases. And if you bring the cases, I'm not saying you win all the time, but you generally speaking have a very good idea that you've got the goods. And so it's one thing, and I'm not minimizing criminal charges out of New York City in connection with, in connection with, you know, hush money payments. Although, as I have said, I think that's a huge stretch. I think that's a case that the prosecution really, they're trying to invent and pursue legal theories which are not at all well established. And I think it's going to be very, very difficult to convict Donald Trump of this hush money cases. This, a federal indictment in connection with the records, that's a different sort of thing. Now, I understand that Donald Trump has gone very, very public and he's making these allegations that this is a political witch hunt, et cetera, et cetera. The Biden Justice Department, these are the arguments, are trying to, you know, weigh in and play politics with the elections and things like that. I understand those arguments. At the same time, though, here you have yet another situation where, while he is trying to run for office, the former president of the United States, a controversial figure, Donald Trump, is now going to be battling federal criminal charges as well as state criminal charges as well as all the other stuff that's going on. And there is the potential for more criminal charges as well. In the next month or two, you're going to have Georgia decide whether they're going to bring charges against Donald Trump in connection with, you know, allegedly trying to interfere with the election. And then perhaps the granddaddy of all charges that are out there is the question of, you know, whether or not there's going to be criminal charges brought against Donald Trump in connection with his alleged involvement with January 6th and the stuff that happened at the Capitol. So you have a number of charges that are out there. The Trump campaign has apparently been of two minds in this. First of all, he's apparently really mad with a lot of his advisors and his attorneys, et cetera, who kept saying, "We don't think you're going to get charged. We don't think you're going to get charged." And now he's been charged. At the same time, the Trump campaign views this as an opportunity to mobilize people who have supported him. His fundraising from big donors is pretty much non-existent. So to the extent he has been able to raise money, it's generally small donors, the people that will send him 25 or 50 or 100 bucks or whatever, who are outraged over the fact that he's, you know, been criminally charged. When he was criminally charged in the New York case, he saw a spike in fundraising, almost all of which was what we're going to call small dollar donors. That has pretty much ebbed. And, you know, most of the people are saying his fundraising is really, at least in the short term, has dried up. Now there's going to be an effort to try to weaponize these charges and say, look, here you've got the deep state. They are so afraid of me that they are trying to bring me down. Our number, 855-616-1620, that is the old National Bank talk and text line. Is this going to hurt Donald Trump and his effort to try to, again, be nominated as the Republican nominee for president? Is this indictment going to hurt him, or could it potentially help him because it will mobilize people to want to send money and feel that, here's another example of where the deep state is going after him? What is the net effect of this going to be? 855-616-1620. We discuss in just a moment. 855-616-1620, which is the old National Bank talk and text line. You know, a number of people on the text line are saying, well, Mike Pence had documents and Joe Biden had documents. And yes, that's true. Now, I'm not commenting on whether or not they should be charged as well. But the difference is, it's one thing to, I don't know, have left office and have some classified records that are stashed somewhere that you don't know about. And I think once these charges come out against, the details come out against President Trump, it's not just that he had the documents. It's that once they discovered that he had the documents, instead of just returning them, he made efforts to conceal the fact that he had them or to stash them or whatever. That's what I think the distinction is going to be. Now, whether or not that's a distinction that a jury, you know, 12 months from now or 18 months from now sees, I don't know. How is this going to impact the election? 855-616-1620, particularly the primaries. Luis in Menominee Falls. Luis, you're on WTMJ. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, sir. It's a pleasure, and thank you for taking my call. Every time I get a chance, I listen to your show. Very interesting.
Thank you. It's very kind of you. What do you think about this?
I have not a controversial opinion, but I have my opinion that I've been making. First of all, to validate my opinion, I'm an Army veteran, disabled veteran from the U.S. Army, served 18 years honorable service, and still fighting for my retirement there. Now, having said that, as an Army veteran and as an American citizen, I believe three specific things that myself, is my personal opinion, that go around this that can create that situation of weaponizing what happens to Mr. Trump. Mm-hmm. Number one is that he has a way, and there's many people like that, psychologists will know that, he has a way of, he's a very influencing person. And those that might be vulnerable in seeking desperately a change in government functions at any level, particularly for presidency in the United States, and especially if they are affected economically and relate everything to that, there'll be a lot of great people always with that vulnerability to be influenced by him, that it wouldn't make a difference mm-hmm. on them whether he gets charged or not. And those are probably those majority that he addresses, that type of people in seeking the weapon, becoming mm-hmm. like a victim, victimize himself, and people feel pity for him and so on. The more educated people, they have probably a more objective issue. And if they are of a particular party, they will do that anyway because just of the fact that they are faithful, more faithful mm-hmm. to a party than being faithful to their own country. The other thing I want to say is that, when Mr. Trump ran for president from the first time and subsequently is trying to do that and now trying to do this again, in my perspective, from the military point of view, I believe, that's my personal opinion, I believe that I always said to myself, why would a billionaire with that capacity to do business at the time when I didn't really know who he was mm-hmm. except that he was a businessman. What a person like that has to do with running for president? I always thought from the beginning that there was a hidden agenda. And I have crossed in my mind that maybe, what if he's a double agent?
Well, Luis, thanks for the call. I want to get a couple of callers. First of all, thank you for your service. And thanks for the opinions. I don't think the double agent. I think, but I do understand. I ask that question a lot about people who get involved in politics, particularly people, it's the lure of power, I think. It's like, okay, my gosh, you're 70-some years old. You've got all the money in the world. You like to play golf. You like to travel around the world. Why do you want to? I ask the question about Joe Biden. What is it that at the age of 82, which was what he would be if he was reelected, right, you can't give up that power? So I think that's a fair question. But going back to your first point, Luis, which I thought was really, really interesting, it's the question becomes, will there be some people out there who again, buy into this notion that he's a victim, he's the only guy that can save us? I guess I look at this, and I know that many of you disagree with me, but I said months ago, and we have the tapes of this, I continue to believe that Donald Trump doesn't make the primaries for a variety of reasons, because at some point in time, I think even if your hardcore supporters, even the most hardcore supporters, sit there and say, okay, at some point in time, the country is more important than any individual. And you can find the Donald Trump policies in other candidates. If you love the policies, you can find that without all the chaos and without all the baggage that's there. Because, look, can you imagine what the next 18 months is going to be like? If you've got the person who's running for president, who's under criminal charges, federal criminal charges, state criminal charges, who's fighting them at the same time. And again, who knows what's going to happen in the Georgia case? Who knows what's going to happen in January 6th? And I think at a lot of times, even some of the most hardcore supporters, I think sit back and say, is it good for the country to put this individual who clearly and maybe Donald Trump is getting screwed over? Maybe you believe, OK, this is all, it's the deep state and they're out to get him and they're out to destroy him. And this is outrageous. But the question becomes, at that point, are there people that just decide we just can't have this chaos anymore? And the country is more important than any individual. So maybe it's time to move on from Donald Trump. I understand he got a fundraising bump, you know, early on when the New York indictment came out. I don't think you're going to see, I think you can only go to the well on that so often. And one of the big differences between now and then is the fact that now you have all sorts of other candidates who are out there. There's what, like 10 potential people running for the presidency, and you know, none of them are under indictment. And as I started off by saying, it's never a good thing. Here's one of our texts. Jeff, the guy creates a lot of his own problems. He could have cooperated with the document issue. Instead, he's playing the victim card again. I believe he's a self-serving narcissist. Jeff, by now, independents and Republicans have long made up their minds about Trump. The indictment will not change this dynamic. It will only provide talking points for his base. Well, see, I think at some point in time, that base starts to diminish. And I understand that there's a hardcore element of the cult of Trump. And I really don't mean that in a bad way. Well, maybe I do. But, you know, the people who are just, it's got to be Trump. It's got to be Trump. He's the only person that can save this country. But there's a much larger group of people who say, you know, we don't want four more years of Biden. We want to win. And Donald Trump, the reality is this is just another one of those nails in the coffin that demonstrate what a number of us have been saying for the longest period of time, that Donald Trump is unelectable, just period, flat out unelectable because of all the baggage. And yes, don't bother texting me saying, well, you didn't think he was going to win in 2016. No, I didn't. But that was a different time. That was a reflection, I think, less of Donald Trump was the unknown guy. Running against Hillary Clinton, who a lot of people just didn't like. This is different. There's nobody out there that does not have an opinion on Donald Trump. And the more you get these charges, the more you get the baggage that comes out, I think the more it demonstrates clearly that this isn't 2016, this isn't 2020, and it's a huge problem. Jeff, I was a big supporter of Trump. That is over for me. I'm actually happy that Mike Pence is running. Jeff, I voted for Trump once and only because of financial reasons. I didn't care for his personality. I think he needs to get out of politics and make friends with whoever is elected as he tries to have a pardon. Jeff, I think they need to throw the book at this guy. I will just tell you what I'm hearing anecdotally. Lots of people who supported Trump in 2016 and supported Trump in 2020, they're not giving any money. They've said we've got to move on. And that's the reality. This just to me makes it more and more apparent that there's no way that Donald Trump could ever be elected president in November of 2024. And you might think that he's the victim here. You might think that he's being screwed over by the system. But this is just the reality. How do you convince independent voters, whether they're slightly left-leaning but they're disaffected with Biden, or slightly right-leaning but they're disaffected with Trump, how do you convince them to vote for somebody who's got federal indictments, who's got state indictments, and who has all this other baggage that's out there? No, I continue to believe, and I've said it before, I don't believe Donald Trump is going to be the Republican nominee. And I'm not – if the fundraising starts to dry up and the poll numbers start to go down, I could easily see, and Donald Trump trying to find a way out, the easiest way is to say, look, I am a victim here. I'm a victim of the deep state. I'm a victim of all this. I've got to, for my sake of my family, I've got to pull out and fight all these unjust charges against me. I can't continue to run for president while I'm doing this. And so it's America's loss. But I could see that happening, especially if yet another shoe drops, either with the Georgia charges or with the January 6th involvement. So I was listening to some pundits saying, OK, this is good for Donald Trump. And again, I go back to circle back to where we started. Having your name on the top of a federal indictment, United States of America, versus fill in the blank, is never, ever a good thing. Here's an interesting text. Jeff, Donald Trump is unelectable only because the media has made him unelectable. If we do not vote Donald Trump, we prove to the media and to the liberal left that they can manipulate elections to their liking. So you gotta vote for Donald Trump to send a message. No, you vote if you're thinking like that. You send the message that you're going to reelect Joe Biden. That's just the bottom line. There are a number of Republicans who are running for office, whether it's Ron DeSantis or Nikki Haley or Tim Scott or Chris Christie. Fill in the blank. I could go on. All of whom I think beat Joe Biden. Donald Trump, at the end of the day, doesn't. He didn't in 2020, and there's nothing about Donald Trump, except criminal charges and all this other baggage that's happened since then, that makes him more electable. So if you insist on voting for Donald Trump, you pretty much guarantee that Joe, 82-year-old Biden, at the day he's inaugurated, will be around for another 4 years, or ultimately, Kamala Harris, if she's the vice presidential candidate, which she will be, takes over. That's the message that you end up sending. I am so delighted to have you spending your Friday afternoon with us. All right. The other announcement yesterday is that it appears that the state legislature, the Republican-controlled state legislature, the state Senate, and the state assembly have cut a deal with Tony Evers regarding the whole shared revenue issue. It is, no matter how you look at it, a huge win for Republicans. And I don't think you should look at stuff necessarily in terms of wins and losses, but this is a win. Let's just back up for a second, and I apologize if we're going over the same ground, but I think some people still don't understand the whole shared revenue concept. What happens in Wisconsin is that we pay state income tax. So we send money off to Madison every year. We also pay a 5% state sales tax when we make purchases. And so that money goes off to Madison. What happens is Madison, then the state government, turns it around and sends money back to communities. That's what they call shared revenue. They share some of the state revenue with various municipalities, counties, cities, etc. The argument has been that municipalities across the state have not been getting their quote-unquote fair share of the revenue. In other words, they're sending more to Madison than they're getting back, and it is unfair. And the argument is this has created financial crises in some communities. It is most clear that that has happened in Milwaukee, Milwaukee County and Milwaukee City. What is the real reason, the big driving factor for this? Well, in Milwaukee County and in the city of Milwaukee, they have their own pension plans. And what's happened is over the years, in making offers and cutting deals with the employees, they have cut all sorts of, at least from the perspective of the taxpayers, very, very bad deals. Here, we're going to give you this amount of money. And part of it has been the idea that it was like really short-term thinking. Okay, we've got these employees that want a 4% raise. Well, we're not going to give them a 4% raise, but what we'll do is we'll boost their contributions to the pension. So it costs them less in the immediate, in the present time, but you create these pension obligations down the road when people start retiring. And on top of that, in the city of Milwaukee, there's been, I think the numbers are like 8 out of the last 19 years, almost half of the last years, that the city of Milwaukee made little or no contributions to the pension fund. They just didn't do it. So the pension obligations kept growing and growing and growing, but the money that the city was putting in to meet those obligations didn't come close to that. So now you're at a point where I think this year alone, they're supposed to come up with $123 million to satisfy pension obligations. So you've got that, and you've got a lot of the reckless spending. The same thing is true with the county. We all know about the Milwaukee County pension scandal, where various employees have become, rich beyond the dreams of avarice because of stuff that was done 20 years ago. And there's nothing you can do to unring that bell. So the city of Milwaukee, because of fiscal mismanagement, The county of Milwaukee, because of fiscal mismanagement over the years, is looking at a crisis. And yes, I can understand, they argue, well, you know, we're not getting enough shared revenue. But part of the reason the problem is as bad as it is again, because of really, really bad spending decisions they've made and really, really bad pension decisions that they've made. But that's the situation they find themselves in. So they want more dough. Bottom line is the deal that has been cut will allow the city of Milwaukee to, if 2/3 of the members of the Common Council vote on it and the mayor signs off on it, it will allow the city of Milwaukee to impose its own 2% sales tax. It will also, if 2/3 of the county board vote on it, the Milwaukee County will be able to impose its own 0.4% sales tax on top of the 0.5% sales tax they already charge. So let's back up. You'll have a 5% state sales tax. You'll have it's 0.9. Let's round up. Let's call it 1% for a county, and then a 2% sales tax for the city. So if you live in the city of Milwaukee, you will pay an 8% sales tax when you buy things. And the argument is this is going to generate this extra revenue, and that revenue is going to then be used to help, you know, pay down these pension problems. There's also going to be more shared revenue coming back. They've changed the formula. But the key to making this deal work is the sales tax that they are imposing. So in the city of Milwaukee, because it's also in Milwaukee County, because you've got the state sales tax, you will be paying 7.9%, let's round up to 8%, on purchases that you make. Conversely, we just bought a dishwasher. Okay, so, and it's a big ticket item. It was, the dishwasher we purchased was over $1,000. But let's, for the sake of argument, let's say it's $1,000. So if this goes through, if we were to go to an appliance store in the city of Milwaukee, we would pay an 8% sales tax on that $1,000 dishwasher. In contrast, if we were to go to an appliance store in Waukesha County or in Ozaukee County or in Washington County, we would pay, I believe, a 5.5% sales tax. So you're paying substantially less in taxes by going to the appliance store in Washington County than you would if you go to the appliance store in the city of Milwaukee. The question becomes, is that going to hurt businesses? Our number is 855-616-1620. That's the old National Bank talk and text line. There are various aspects of this deal that are interesting to me, and we'll get into that maybe in just a little bit. But I want to start off with this fundamental question. Do you think this is going to hurt Milwaukee businesses in the long term? Will people make decisions to shop outside the city in order to essentially save the difference between an 8% sales tax and a 5.5% sales tax? Will people change their buying habits in order to avoid an extra 2.5%? 855-616-1620. We discuss in a moment. 855-616-1620, which is the old National Bank talk and text line. And a number of listeners are pointing out that not every county has a 0.5% sales tax, which is correct. Some do, but many don't. So if that was the case, and somebody was saying that Waukesha doesn't, and I think that's correct. So if that was the case, let's say you're going to buy that dishwasher, $1,000 dishwasher. And the difference in taxes on the $1,000 dishwasher would be, if you buy it in the city of Milwaukee, if this goes through, you would be paying 7.9%. Let's round up to 8%, so $80. If, on the other hand, you drove across 124th Street, found an appliance store, and purchased the same dishwasher for the same price, you'd be paying $50 in that case in taxes. Would that extra $30 in taxes, in my example, would that make a difference? And I'm picking that as a large sort of ticket item for people who are saying, well, what about cars? under Wisconsin state law, you pay, it doesn't matter where you buy the car. It matters where you register the car. So if you live in the city of Milwaukee and you don't drive out to Menominee Falls and you buy a car, you're going to pay the Milwaukee sales tax because it's where you register it. That applies to cars and boats, but it doesn't apply to, you know, anything else. 855-616-1620. Lamar in Orlando. Lamar, you're on WTMJ. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Jeff. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So when I was still with the transit system down there, you know, I was a lobbyist, and we were pushing to get the sales tax for transit. And this was one of the arguments against the sales tax. It's like, it's going to hurt businesses. People are going to go, you know, out of the county to purchase stuff. And it's an absurd argument. Most consumers aren't doing that kind of math. Now, those that are, you know, particular to their dollars, they're watching every dime. But most people aren't like that. Most people are going to shop, you know, where it's close. Because if this were the case, if this were true, let's say this is true. The number of Milwaukeeans and people from Chicago that drive down to Chicago to, or people from Wisconsin that drive down to Chicago to shop where their sales tax is 11% wouldn't go if that were the case. They would just stay at home. You see what I'm saying? But they don't do that. People shop where it's convenient, where it's close. And they look at the, you know, they're not looking at the details of taxes.
Okay,
I don't believe the average consumer's doing that.
So in the example I gave, let's take a dishwasher, you know, a relatively high end appliance. Mm-hmm. And so you don't think that, your opinion is that you don't think that that extra $30 or $29 or whatever it is on that $1,000 purchase, you don't think that that's enough to say to somebody, well, instead of buying it at an appliance store at Mayfair, I'm going to go out to Brookfield and buy it.
Maybe those that are hyper cost conscious, most consumers don't move that way. Most consumers, if I live, let's say, on the east side of Milwaukee, and
right.
If I live right on the border, it's one thing. Okay, maybe they could pick that up. But most people, if I live on the east side of Milwaukee, I'm not going to drive all the way out to Brookfield. Mm-hmm. If there's a store 5 minutes from me that sells the same dishwasher, I'm going to drive right by me.
Okay. Now, thanks. Well, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I guess that's what it'll play out. One of our texters says, small purchases, no. And right. I mean, if you're going to, I don't know, you're going to, and I certainly agree with that. You've got, you know, you want to go to, I don't know, I'm going to say a drugstore or whatever, and you're going to make $15 or $20 worth of purchases, right? That extra few pennies isn't going to necessarily make a difference. Anyways, the texter says, small purchases, no. Medium purchases, maybe. Large purchases, absolutely. Retail and commercial space right over the Milwaukee County line just became a lot more valuable. Jeff, I would drive from Glendale to Brookfield to save that money. Jeff, people only drive to Chicago to go to the high-end stores, right? I guess we're going to see how that all plays out. My experience with people who go to Chicago to shop, for example, and maybe this is just the people I know, is that they go to Chicago to shop because there is a perception that they are getting something that they can't get in Milwaukee. Now, whether that's real or not, I don't know. But it's like, hey, we're going to go to some of the high-end clothing stores on Michigan Avenue because there's nothing comparable in Milwaukee. And we understand that when we go down there, what we're going to do is we're going to end up having to pay more, including the tax. But they're going there for a particular purpose. In my example, where you've got the KitchenAid dishwasher, and it's going to be the same KitchenAid dishwasher whether you buy it from Charlie's Appliance Store in Mequon or whether you buy it from Sam's Appliance Store in the city of Milwaukee. That's the question that's there. Will it impact? And I guess to me, I don't see how it cannot impact on this, which is, I think, one of the considerations. It's one of the reasons I believe that local officials, after years and years and years of begging to have the ability to increase the sales tax, but arguing that we're going to have a referendum to do it, right? I mean, that was the argument we had for years. Let us, it's local control, let us have a referendum. And that was actually an argument that I found appealing. Yeah, if people want to raise their taxes, do it. The fact that once this was a reality and you had so many local elected officials and members of the business community that then started to do the Chicken Little thing saying the sky is falling, they were afraid because they were afraid that if you actually did you know, ask people whether they would vote to raise their taxes, they would end up saying no, and the thing would end up failing. So it's this interesting dynamic that is out there. Is this going to hurt businesses? Of course it's going to hurt businesses. Will it cause restaurant industry to dry up? No, I don't think it's going to be that. But I do think that you're going to see, particularly in the higher ticket items. I mean, I guess if I had a choice between, I don't know, buying, again, the appliance, you're going to buy a refrigerator or a stove or whatever, and the choice is, do you buy it in the city of Milwaukee, or do you go across, do you go out to Brookfield, or do you go to Mequon, or do you even drive to Brown Deer or something like that, where if you drive to Brown Deer, you avoid that 2% sales tax increase, you pay an extra point or whatever. I think it is going to have an impact, and I think it's probably going to cause a lot of retailers, particularly the people that depend on selling the higher end products, it's going to cause them to rethink where they are. I do want to make one thing clear, because again, I keep getting these texts about this, that for cars and boats, it doesn't matter. Cars and boats, it depends where you register your car. So if you live in the city of Milwaukee and your car is registered in the city of Milwaukee, doesn't matter where you buy that car in the state of Wisconsin, you are still paying the sales tax from the community where you bought it. So driving to Menominee Falls doesn't help you get a break on the car. It does help you get a break on the dishwasher or the stove or some of the other higher-end items. Is it going to have an impact? Well, time will tell. When we come back after the top of the hour news, I want to talk about a real interesting study that's out there saying how many people have left the city of Milwaukee and why. I also have a couple more thoughts on the shared revenue deal. So don't go anywhere. This is Jeff Wagner, WTMJ.
Live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios at The Avenue, it's the Jeff Wagner Show. Now, here's WTMJ's Jeff Wagner.
Good afternoon, Wisconsin. Welcome back to the program. Once again, if you want to watch us through Spoken Word Radio, easy to do it. We have our own YouTube channel. Just go to YouTube and put in WTMJ and you'll see us. You can also live stream us by going to WTMJ.com. You can click on the Listen Live button. You can click on the Watch Live button. And there we are. And it's always interesting to me how many people choose to do that. It's always fun as well. Okay, just a couple thoughts on the shared revenue deal before we move on to something else. I think, and I said earlier, I think it's a really good deal. First of all, there's no question. Milwaukee in general, I'm talking about Milwaukee County and the city, is in a financial mess. And there's just no question about it. Now, I understand that there's people who don't want to take responsibility for why it's in a financial mess, who say, well, we haven't gotten our share of shared revenue, et cetera. Well, it's there might be an element of that, but it's also because the governments around here, whether it's the pension spending or spending on other stuff, have spent money in a way that you would describe it's spending money like a drunken sailor, but for the fact that that would be an insult to drunken sailors. So as part of this deal, the argument has always been, okay, let's give the city of Milwaukee or let's give Milwaukee County more money. But what's going to happen is if they just pee it away like they've peed it away in the past, you're going to be in the same situation. You're going to have to be giving them more and more money. So there's a couple key elements of this. First of all, they're getting more money back, but there are limitations on how the money can be spent. For example, you can't spend it to build to extend the stupid trolley that nobody rides. I was downtown yesterday. Like I said, we came back from the train station, went to the train station. I saw trolley after trolley running, and I swear there was nobody on any of them. People just aren't riding this. So what would happen is, as part of this, there are minimums. In order to get this money, you have to guarantee that you're going to have at least, what's the number, almost 1,800 sworn police officers, a certain percentage of those who are detectives. You're going to have to guarantee a minimum number of firefighters. So there is assurances that you're not going to be able to just kind of take this money and throw it away. On top of that, there's going to be a transition. New employees aren't going to be able to jump onto this extremely generous pension plan that they have for the city of Milwaukee or Milwaukee County. Instead, you're going to be part of the state pension plan, which, by the way, is still pretty darn generous. It's just nowhere near as rich as the deals that they cut over the years with city employees or with county employees. So that's going to be a way of saving. So it's not just here, we're giving you more money. There are strings attached to it. Now, those strings are going to be, I know one of the things that might make it a challenge to get a two-thirds vote to approve this among the county board or the common council. But that's a whole different story. If the city of Milwaukee or the Milwaukee Common Council is willing to say no to this money because they don't like the strings, well, all right, then they got to figure out how to deal with the pension plan. But they really don't have, I don't think they're in a position where, well, what's the phrase we use? Beggars can't be choosers. And at this point in time, that is exactly what the situation is. But here's the other aspect of this deal. It's also tied in with education funding. And this deal, if it is passed by the legislature, signed by the governor, is going to be one of the historic days when that happens for the school choice movement in Wisconsin. Now, here's the deal. For school districts, the public schools, the average, I'm talking about average, the average payment that the state makes per pupil, according to the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction, is $15,300. Some districts are a lot more, some are less, but the average is $15,300. State aid, let's say you have a kid who doesn't want to, or his parents don't want to send him or her to the public school system, and they want to go to charter schools or to independent private schools and the parental choice programs, the contribution that the state make is only about 60% or about $9,000 per child. So what's going to happen is, as a part of this deal, for students in private choice schools in kindergarten through eighth grade, tuition is going to raise from the current $8,400 to about $9,500. So it's going to go up by $1,100. For choice students in high school, it's going to increase about $3,000 from $9,000 now to about $12,000. So the estimates are that this is going to make it dramatically more affordable for the private schools or the choice schools to take kids. Because the way the law works right now is that if you are a private school or a choice school, what happens is you are not allowed, and you're taking a kid who's part of this voucher program or whatever, you're not allowed to charge them the difference. So what you have to do is you have to make up that difference through fundraising, et cetera. Since, like I say, charter schools can't charge tuition at all, and private schools can't charge tuition for most students using choice vouchers. So what this will do is it will allow these schools to take more kids, because even though there's a difference in what they have to spend, it's nowhere near as dramatic. This is a huge win for, like I say, the private school, the school choice movement, and that cannot be underestimated. So that's another part of this deal, which is, I think it's key. There's also an increase in funding to go to the public schools, and that's all well and good. Tony Evers doesn't get as much as he wanted, but this is a good day for the private school movement, and that's another reason why this is such a good deal. Okay, let's take a quick break. When we come back, the numbers are in. People are moving. We now know why. Stick around. One of the fun things about the Watch Live aspect is that there's a number of people who like to comment on the clothing we wear. For example, one of our regular listeners says, Jeff, the stitching on your Tobago Bay sweatshirt, well, it's actually like a pullover, is very well coordinated with your white polo, to which I said, thank you very much. My wife thought so as well as I was heading out the door. You can check that out again by going to simply go to WTMJ.com and click on the Watch Live if you choose to do it. Okay. A number of years ago, back when Scott Walker was the governor, the residency rule, this goes back to June of 2023. The city, before that, the city required residency in Milwaukee as a condition of employment. You had to, if you were a city employee, you had to live within the city. That was lifted by the legislature. And there weren't, Milwaukee wasn't the only city that had a residency rule, but it was one of the few. There weren't that many. In most communities, the idea was you don't have to live, you don't have to be a prisoner of the city boundaries to live there. But Milwaukee had that. In any event, that was tossed out by the legislature and upheld by the state Supreme Court. We're now starting to look at the numbers, and there's a story in the local newspaper that kind of makes this point. All right, since 2013, so over the last 10 years, the number of Milwaukee City employees living within Milwaukee dropped 43%. 43%. This translates to nearly 3,000 city workers who were leaving the city of Milwaukee and moving to the suburbs. That's about half of the workforce. 59% of the exodus comes from sworn members of the police and fire departments. So what they're saying is that you have almost half the employees who decided we don't want to live in the city where we work. And of that overall half, about 60% of the police and firefighters have decided to move out of the city. It's just kind of staggering. Just over 3,700 city employees were living in Milwaukee in July of 2022. So that translates to about 56% of city workers. Okay, but that means 44% have chosen to move elsewhere. And the largest collection of city workers who still live in Milwaukee are congregated in two Southside aldermanic districts. So one of the questions becomes, and this is the question I always asked as well, given the fact that the employees are now free to leave, why do they choose to leave? Because you would think in many cases you'd want to, you know, live near where it is that you work. And it's interesting because when they talk to the people that leave, 56% of police officers that left, 41% of fire department workers who left, you want to guess what the number one reason they had for moving out of the city? These are cops and firefighters. Okay, just think about this for a minute. What would be the number one reason? Well, if you said safety, you would be correct. So 56% of police say, we're moving out because we are concerned about crime. Second, 34% said we're moving out because of schools. 34% said schools. And you're basically talking MPS, you know, we want to move to other districts where we think the schools are better. And then the third factor that they list is cost of living. And I would tie in property taxes and things like that. Okay, our number is 855-616-1620. That is the old National Bank talk and text line. So there's no doubt about it. There has been a huge migration of city employees since the residency rules were done away with. Some people say, well, this is just terrible. You should live in the community where you work, and it's terrible that people are moving, and we need to reinstate the residency rules. Good luck with that. We need to reinstate the residency rules and make people move back. You should be forced to work in the community where you are getting paid, or at least you should be forced to work in Milwaukee, because like I say, lots of communities, even before this, did not have residency rules. That's one way of looking at it. The other way of looking at it, though, is does this demonstrate that perhaps there's a problem? Does this demonstrate that there's a problem? And by that, I mean if you've got employees who want to get out of Dodge, is the right response to say, no, 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 we want to bring them back. We want to force them to live in this community. Or alternatively, does it tell you about something about the community? If the cops, 56% of the cops who are moving out, say they are concerned with crime, does it tell you maybe that you as a community are doing a lousy job of dealing with crime? If 34% say we are concerned about the schools, well, does that tell you that they're concerned that maybe you're doing a lousy job with the schools? And rather than, okay, saying we need to have these artificial rules which force people to live in a particular area, shouldn't you be dealing with maybe the underlying issue, which is why they're moving out in the first place? Like, try to deal with crime so it's not so imperative for people to get out. Our number is 855-616-1620. Should they reinstate residency rules, Or alternatively, use this as a teachable moment to understand what the problems are and address the underlying problems. 855-616-1620. We discuss. Which is the old National Bank talk and text line. The numbers are in, and it really is staggering. You have, you end up looking at, for example, in the last 10 years, the number of police officers who've decided to move outside of the city of Milwaukee. And it's almost, it's just a staggering number. You know, more than 50% are moving outside of the city. And so I guess you can look at this one of two ways. Oh, this is terrible. These people are leaving the city. How can we allow it to happen? Or maybe the question should be, why is it that they're leaving? And we know it's crime, it's schools. Maybe we should use that as a way of saying, okay, we got to address what's going on here, because if you make it a desirable place to live, then people aren't going to be bailing. 855-616-1620, Scott in Milwaukee. Scott, you're on WTMJ.
Good afternoon, Jeff.
Hi, Scott.
Yes, I believe you're absolutely right. You have to fix the underlying causes and problems to keep this from happening. I was a city employee for 30 years. I stayed because my children were grown by the time the rules changed. Had that been different, I would have been gone.
Why?
My children's education would have been first and foremost, then the safety of my family.
Yeah.
I don't want to run into the people that I deal with within the city that I live in.
Yeah. No, I think that's kind of the reality of this. And instead of just saying, okay, we need to make the city workers, you know, prisoners, I think people would love to live in the community that they live in general, but you've got to make it desirable for them to do that. And if you think the schools are crummy or you're afraid of safety, you know, you have to, it's the logical reaction. Deal with the underlying problem instead of saying, like, why are people moving? You know, fix that problem and then they won't move.
I agree 100%.
Yeah, no, thanks to call, Scott. Appreciate it. David in Milwaukee. David, you're on WTMJ.
Hi, Jeff.
Hi, David.
Yeah, my son is a Milwaukee police officer. You know, they arrest a lot of people in this city, and we live in a small city regardless of what we think we live in. You know, they're driving around, they're with their family, they spot somebody or somebody pulls up next to them that they've arrested. Now they have to deal with that when they have their family with them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, plus the school system, MPS, money poorly spent, yeah, is broken. You know, I sent my son to Marquette High School,
yeah,
because I wasn't going to send him to a public school when I resided in the city of Milwaukee.
Yeah.
And you know, when she left, there was $50,000. Now it's probably $80,000 to send him to school, and he just felt, I can't afford that kind of money, so he moved to a suburb.
Yeah, and it makes sense. And we're not even talking about, like, the property taxes, and we're not even talking about, like we have discussed in the last half hour of the program, you know, the increase in sales tax and things like this. You've got the cost of living issues as well. Now, look, there's always going to be one of the other reasons I don't think people moving out is so bad necessarily is because it retains these employees. You know, what was happening before when you had the residency rule is you had people that would quit. I mean, they wanted to be cops. They appreciated what they were doing. They wanted to be teachers. You know, this numbers doesn't include the teachers. They wanted to be teachers, but you know, your life ends up changing. Okay, it's one thing when you're young. You're a young teacher, for example. You're living, you know, in an apartment or whatever. You get married. You want to have a kid. You want to move to a space where there's a bigger lawn, et cetera, et cetera. So there's always going to be some of that. And one of the things that by allowing people to live wherever they want to live, one of the things you do is you make retention easier because you don't force people to make those difficult choices that our last caller was talking about, hey, I'm not going to send my kid to, you know, the MPS schools, but at the same time, where am I going to get the dough to send them to private schools? And I want to send my kid to, I don't know, the Glendale Nicolet system, or I want to send my kid to, you know, whatever, the Waukesha school system, or I want to move out to Pewaukee because they've got a great school system, or Sussex, or wherever that might be. You now don't make people have to make that choice versus their jobs, and so you don't have that drain of people that you have often. But the truth of the matter is, if it were desirable to live in an area where you work, people would live in the area where they work. So maybe if you look at these numbers, the takeaway should be, let's fix the underlying problem. To that point, when we come back in just a minute, I want to tell you about an underlying problem that I don't see anybody working to fix. I'm Jeff Wagner. Coming up at the top of the hour, Jack Smith, who is the special prosecutor. They've now unsealed the Donald Trump indictment. As I said at the start of the show, if you take nothing away from this three-hour program, take it from a recovering attorney and a former federal prosecutor. You never, ever, ever want to see your name on the top of a federal indictment. United States of America versus whatever. Never a good thing. The indictment's been unsealed. Trump has been charged with 37 counts of various criminal activities regarding the classified government records. And we will carry at least a portion of the press conference with the prosecutor. That's going to be at 2 o'clock. When we come back in just a couple minutes, though, all right, you know, we were talking about like the cops moving out because crime is out of control. There is one crime that continues to be completely and totally out of control, and it's way past time for the legislature, the courts, the DA's office, and everybody to deal with it. I will tell you about that, and we'll discuss in just a moment. The actual indictment that has now been unsealed, let's see, 37 counts. 31 counts accuse Trump of willful retention of national defense information. He's also charged with conspiracy to obstruct justice. That is not good. Withholding a document or record, corruptly concealing a document or record, concealing a document in a federal investigation, a scheme to conceal, and false statements and representation. So, not good. Just not good. 2 o'clock this afternoon, we'll again dip into the press conference that the prosecutor, Jack Smith, is scheduled to have. Okay. A week ago today, about 11 o'clock in the morning, what happened was that they call it the Flock License Plate Recognition Cameras, LPR. And they've got these cameras all over the area. They've got the cameras in that North Point parking lot down by the lakefront. There's a custard stand there and things like that. So apparently they get a hit, and that there is a vehicle in that parking lot whose license plate comes back is stolen. All right. So what they do is they dispatch sheriff's deputies, and Milwaukee County sheriff's deputies are responsible for patrolling that portion of for that parking lot and that portion, Lincoln Memorial Drive. So what happens is you have sheriff's deputies that are dispatched there. And perhaps you've seen the video. You have a female sheriff's deputy who gets out to go up to the car. She's investigating, again, the stolen vehicle. Goes up to the side of the car and, you know, tries to get the person who's behind the wheel of the car to come out. And ultimately what happens, I think she opens the door or he opens the door, whatever. But instead of coming out and surrendering, the driver of the vehicle like backs up and then drives forward, and she's dragged by this car, and the car then flees. The stolen vehicle flees, bangs into another parked car there, and then drives off. Thankfully, the injuries to the sheriff's deputies were minor. There is a 19-year-old who is a passenger in the car who's trying to bail as all this is going on. He's arrested, and they find a gun with him. Okay, so what happens is they then conduct their investigation, and the 21-year-old who was driving the stolen car, and they were able to get an idea as to who he was. He ended up being taken into custody a couple days ago. They made the arrest of him, and now he's, you know, looking at charges as well, because what happened is after he drives away in this stolen car, he abandons it in an alley on the east side, and investigators are able to use evidence found in the vehicle to identify him, and he's taken into custody Wednesday morning. So we have the deal, and he's going to end up being charged, and there was a gun in the car, as you might expect, and things like that. But the interesting aspect of this is that the lakefront and this parking lot has apparently become, you know, just a hangout for like stolen cars. The sheriff's department said they've had 17 encounters with stolen vehicles at the lakefront in the last 30 days. 17 encounters with stolen cars at the lakefront in the last 30 days. This isn't in Milwaukee County. This is at the lakefront. That's like one every 2 days, a little bit more than that. So it demonstrates, again, something that we've been talking about for, well, it seems like years now, the rash of car thefts that we have here. People are stealing cars, and they're stealing cars to joyride in them or whatever, and they're not afraid of what could happen. Then when they're confronted by the police, they take off. But it's almost like you're just, you know, you park your car anywhere in the city of Milwaukee, and you got to almost expect that you're going to come out and you're going to find that car gone. And a lot of the cars that are stolen, not all, but a lot of the cars that are stolen by juveniles, in many cases, people under the age of 16. And under state law, you cannot waive. If you got a 15-year-old or a 14-year-old that's stolen 5 or 10 or 20 or 50 cars, and they haven't killed anybody as they're driving off in that stolen car, you can't waive them into adult court. You can't treat them as adults. If you have somebody who's 16 or more who's stolen multiple cars, it's a matter of discretion, but for all practical purposes, the district attorney's office, they're not going to treat you as an adult. They're going to continue to treat you as a juvenile unless, again, you drive off and you hit and kill somebody. In that case, it's a different story. But that doesn't change the underlying fact that you've got cars that are being stolen right and left. And this isn't, oh, Kia makes it too easy to steal or Hyundai makes it too easy to steal. This is you have bad people out there who are stealing cars right and left, who are not afraid at all. Number one, they're not afraid that they're going to be caught. And number two, if they are caught, they're not afraid of any consequences because we don't do anything to them. Our number is 855-616-1620. That is the Old National Bank talk and text line. If you are watching us on our live streaming, you are about ready to watch my head absolutely explode about this. This is not how we should be forced to live. We should not be held hostage by the criminals and the punks that are out there who think that they can just steal our cars and get away with it. Because anybody who has ever had their car stolen understands it is far from a victimless crime. The district attorney's office might not get that. The Milwaukee County judges might not get it. But when your car is stolen, it is a huge, first of all, it is a hassle. Secondly, it is an invasion of privacy. Third, it is a huge expense on so many different levels. Why do we not treat this more significantly? Why do we not have a law that allows people, I'd say as young as 13, to be waived into adult court if there are multiple car thefts? Why, as a matter of policy, don't we treat a theft of a car worth thousands and thousands of dollars? Why don't we treat it as what it is, a felony, and treat people like adults when they do it? Whatever happened to accountability? 855-616-1620. I don't have the breakdown of the 17 people that have been stopped and stolen cars over the course of the last 30 days at the lakefront. My guess is the vast majority of them are minors. My guess is at least, I'd say close to a majority of them are probably 16 or under. When are the elected officials, the prosecutors, and the judges going to realize that we've got to start treating car thieves more seriously? 855-616-1620. And if you have ever been the victim of car theft, you know precisely what I'm talking about. We discuss in just a moment. 855-616-1620. Jeff, don't you understand? It's not the poor juvenile delinquent's fault. It's the car manufacturer's fault. Now my head is exploding. You know, I said yesterday I went to Chicago, saw West Side Story. And, of course, that's the story. It's Romeo and Juliet set against, you know, like gangs in the 50s, the Jets and the Sharks and things like that. And it's like, oh, there's the one song called Officer Krupke. And say, it's not our fault. You know, it's why are we being punished? And the bottom line is you got a lot of these car thieves who are simply absolutely 100% no good. Period. And this is going to continue to go on and on and on until we recognize that, you know, we can't build a new juvenile detention facility that holds 32 people at a cost of tens of millions of dollars because it's going to be full, or it should be full, the first day that it opens. Let's talk to Gianni in Montello. You're on WTMJ. Hello.
Hello, Jeff. Great topic. Listen, things will change when our judges and prosecutors begin to realize that America is not the center of the universe. We have to look for foreign examples of how they deal with criminal issues, whether juvenile or adult. And I pose the question, how many cars are stolen in Beijing every day, or Moscow, or Singapore, or Saudi Arabia, or Tokyo, or Japan, or South Korea? Until we adopt a foreign model, probably much more austere than we have in the United States, this is going to continue happening in Milwaukee and all over America. Yeah, and you're right, it is a terrible inconvenience.
Well, thanks. I mean, my response is like baby steps. I'm not here on the radio advocating caning or things like that, but I am advocating consequences. And what you're seeing is whether it's people are saying, well, this is gang initiations, or I don't know what this is, but you know, this, it is an epidemic, and it's an epidemic that has gotten worse and worse and worse. Now, some people might say, well, there's not as many car thefts this year as there were last year. Well, there couldn't be as many this year as last year. I mean, it's just, but it is an enormous number that are out there. And then, of course, it's not just the car thieves, but then what we see what ends up happening. The police go out to look. They try to pull the stolen car over. The car takes off. In this case, you get a sheriff's deputy who thankfully is only injured minorly. And then, of course, what do they find? They find guns in the car. I don't know. They haven't announced the name of the 21-year-old that they ended up arresting. But would I be surprised if it turns out that that 21-year-old either has a felony or a felony conviction as an adult, or maybe because he's only been an adult for a couple years, that he's got a lengthy juvenile record? Of course not. I mean, this will be par for the course. And what you will find, I will bet you dollars to donuts, is that there was no consequences at all. Jeff, build the detention center larger. We might save money locking the hoodlums up versus the medical care they're costing us due to the injuries that they end up causing. Jeff, even if your vehicle wasn't stolen, you are a victim because of the insurance company. In the last 6 months, my premium has gone up close to 40%, supposedly because of my make or model. Yeah, it's also going to probably go up because depending on what neighborhood that you live in. Oh, how can they do that? Well, okay, they base it on risk. And the fact is that if you live in areas where cars are stolen off the street on a regular basis, it's going to cost you money as well. But we just tolerate this. I mean, seriously, you have these stories, and the police will tell you this. They will find these juvenile delinquents out there who have, you know, stolen multiple cars, and they keep getting caught. And let's be honest, unless you're a really stupid criminal or really unlucky, you don't necessarily get caught the first time you've stolen a car. You get caught maybe the seventh or eighth time or whatever. We see some of the effects of this car theft. Like, remember the kid who's driving the car outside the middle school and slams into the rear of the school bus, you know, remember that, and severely injures one of his passengers who's hanging out the window while these kids are joyriding. There's no fear of consequences. There's no sense of responsibility. And it's almost at a point where, I mean, if the sheriff's department wanted to jack up their stats, my guess is just drive through the lakefront, that North Point Custard Stand parking lot, drive through that at any time of the day or night, and you're going to find just a boatload of stolen cars. They got 17 encounters at the lakefront in the last 30 days with stolen cars, and my guess is that's just the tip of the iceberg. It's got to stop. It's getting worse. It is making this community unlivable. And look, here's the bottom line. Most people are good people. That's just the truth. See, that's what's so frustrating to me. Most kids out there, most 16-year-olds, it would not occur to them to steal somebody's car. Most 14 and 15-year-olds, it wouldn't occur to them to, okay, go joyriding in some stolen car. There is a certain criminal element. They are hoodlums or want to be hoodlums. They do it because they think it's going to be fun. They do it because they think it makes them important. They do it because they know they can get away with it. And until we stop allowing them to get away with it, they're going to continue to do it. So, yeah, let's catch them. Let's prosecute them. Let's treat them like adults if they're repeats. But, you know, you steal a $15,000 or $20,000 car. Why shouldn't you be off the street for a year or two? Seriously. And maybe if we started doing that, maybe, just maybe, some of them would rethink stealing multiple cars. Just saying. Something completely different. Again, it's one of my little irritants here. So, UPS. I had ordered something that was being that I needed, and it was I ordered it through this outfit that was going to get it, and they were going to ship it UPS. That's great because I needed it kind of right away. So, what I didn't realize when I ordered it was that UPS was going to deliver it, but it needed a signature. Well, okay, I'm not home during the day, and my wife is home a lot of times, but, you know, she's out and about. So the document, the package that I ordered, it came like 2 days ago, and we get this notice saying, okay, it's been delivered. We couldn't drop it off. We couldn't leave it because it needed a signature. You know, we'll come back, and it gives the next day. Well, that doesn't help us because the next day I'm gone too. You know, I'm gone, and Fran had stuff to do, so we're both gone. So I'm like, okay, well, this is not something I want to have sent back to the place. So I'm exploring these different options, and I find if I open this account with UPS, I can have it delivered instead of to my house. I can have it sent to the UPS store that is right down the street from where I live. Problem solved, right? Okay. So I register. I open this account. I say, okay, I want it. And I might have done this in the first place, except I didn't know I was going to have to sign for it. So, okay, fine. I open this account. I am able to stop the second day delivery, and I want to have it sent to the UPS store. They say, that's fine, but we need your credit card because it's going to cost you $8. It's going to cost you $8 additionally to have the UPS driver drive it to the UPS store instead of coming back to my house and trying to unsuccessfully deliver it yesterday and then presumably unsuccessfully deliver it today because I'm not there. Now, I needed the document. I paid the $8, went over this morning on the way to work and picked up the document. No problem. But seriously, $8 for the privilege of me driving to the UPS store to pick it up. I mean, for goodness sakes, they should be paying me $8 because they don't have to come out to my house. All right. A lot of stuff coming up in the 2 o'clock hour of the program. Do not go anywhere. Yeah, this is Jeff Wagner, WTMJ. Do we have the feed? Are we carrying the feed? Because that's one of the questions that people are going to want to know. Why did they move this to Florida? Do we know? Do we have that? Okay. All right. Well, that's Jack Smith announcing. Let's see if we can we'll take a couple questions if we can figure out what's happened to the feed there. That's one of the questions. This is and I mean, I think there's a pretty clear answer to this as to why they decided to avoid jurisdictional issues and move it to the area where, to the extent you believe that there was a crime committed, that crime would have been committed in Mar-a-Lago. So do we have the feed or not? Okay, tell you what, let's take a very quick break. We'll come back, see where we are. They've just ended the press conference, so he's not taking questions on this. Okay, got it. Well, that's what you have is actually, I think that's quite candidly, I think he handled this appropriately. I was always taught as a federal prosecutor that the public, the United States Department of Justice, the people, as it were, speak through the indictments that are returned. And, you know, and then you present your evidence in the court of law. I think it's I cringe sometimes when I see prosecutors, whether it's state prosecutors or federal prosecutors, that, you know, go on and they have these lengthy press conferences where they, you know, they detail their interpretation of the case and they detail, you know, the evidence that they think is there and things like that. That's really for a trial. Now, I understand that when you have a defendant, in this case, a defendant like Donald Trump, they're not bound by those same rules. And there's no question that former President Trump is going to will try to try this case in the press like he's done, you know, with other sorts of things. And as a criminal defendant, he has the right to do it. But the prosecutors play by different sort of rules. If you're just tuning in, they have unsealed the indictment. It's 37 counts in connection with the records that were seized. And I think one of the big questions that I think a lot of people are going to have is why do they indict Trump? Why didn't they indict Mike Pence? Why didn't they indict Joe Biden? You found records in Biden's garage next to his Corvette and things like this. I will offer my theory on this, and that is that it's not just that they found records. It's not just that, oh, as you're boxing up your stuff from your days as the vice president, you've got some documents that inadvertently got stuck in the box along with other stuff and stashed in your garage. That's not a good thing, but there's not evidence of a criminal intent to take those documents. It's just, okay, we found these documents. Here they are. We're giving them back. And it's not like anything was done with them. The theory I think the prosecutors are operating on is that this was not an inadvertent taking of records. And it wasn't a situation where, oh my gosh, we found that we've got two or three boxes of classified records. Here, let's just give them back to the National Archives. I think the prosecution's theory is going to be that, you know, once these records were either knowingly taken and maintained, or once it was discovered that these records had been taken, there was an effort to then maintain them when you knew you didn't have a right to them. That's where I think that they're going with this. How that plays out, I guess we're going to have to wait and see. And again, for people who are wondering why this is in the Southern District of Florida, that's because that's where Mar-a-Lago is. And originally, the investigation, I think, was being conducted out of D.C., you know, what's going on here. But the venue, that's the term they use. The venue, I think, is more appropriately the Southern District of Florida, because that's where they found the documents. How this all plays out, I don't know. But just circling back to something I said at the very start of the show that I stand by, seeing your name at the top of a federal indictment is never, ever a good thing, because federal prosecutors, it's different than state prosecutors. Federal prosecutors kind of pick and choose their cases, and rarely, I'm not saying they never happens, but they rarely take these flyers. This is a serious challenge, I think, to Donald Trump. And I think the evidence that they discovered over the course of their investigation, at least in the opinion of the prosecutors, is causing them to treat this differently than, oh, we found a couple, you know, the documents in a file in Mike Pence's office, or, you know, Joe Biden had these documents in a box. Sloppy on the part of Pence, sloppy on the part of Biden, but not necessarily criminal. A couple of our texters say, come on, Jeff, wake up. Don't you see that this is all political? This is just an effort to destroy Donald Trump. I'm going to tell you how I see this. I do not, when you talk about political and effort to destroy Donald Trump, you got to understand, Democrats are salivating at the prospect of running against Donald Trump. Donald Trump is a divisive figure that might be the one Republican candidate who has no chance of beating Joe Biden. He just doesn't. You know, you explain to me how Donald Trump is going to win. Reverse what happened. The states he lost in 2020. Explain to me how Donald Trump is going to reverse that. Explain to me how he's going to win in Wisconsin. It's just not flat out going to happen. No, the Democrats, they want to see Donald Trump be the nominee because Donald Trump has so much baggage. I mean, everybody has a little bit of baggage, but let's face it, Trump does not pack lightly. No, I think Democrats would salivate at the chance of having Trump as the Republican nominee. I think I understand that there's the cult of Trump, and I understand there's people who think he's the only person who can save the country, but I think most people recognize it is time to move on. So no, I don't see the political aspect of this. I don't see anything that Jack Smith has done that indicates to me that this is sort of a witch hunt. Once again, this is one of these, to me, self-induced problems by Donald Trump. The fact that, you know, you took the records in the first place, and then whether you took them on purpose or not, once you realized that, you know, you weren't supposed to have them, you just didn't give them back right away. And that's where the obstruction of justice stuff comes in. This is just another one of these examples where I think in many cases Trump is his own worst enemy. And this is, whether it's arrogance or whatever, this is another example of that playing out. And I'm looking at the pictures of like box after box after box of these classified records that if you took them by mistake, I guess I can understand that. But once you find out you've got them, just give them back. And then you're on a different footing than efforts to try to not give them all back or require the search warrant or things like this. So, I mean, look, I don't know if the government's going to be able to prove that he's guilty beyond a reasonable doubt or not. But this idea that, oh, this is nothing but a political witch hunt, well, ask what he was doing with the records in the first place. And this does put other Republicans, I think, in an uncomfortable position because they're reluctant to come out and say what I believe is the facts, that this is just whether it's criminal intent or just arrogance or sloppiness or whatever, it's another one of these self-induced problems created by Donald Trump. To that extent, my friend and teammate John McCure tells me that Congressman Mike Gallagher is going to be on Wisconsin's Afternoon News this afternoon, and they will ask Congressman Gallagher about the indictment. Congressman Gallagher is in the news as well because he announced today that he is not going to be a candidate for the Republican nomination for Senate to run against Tammy Baldwin in 2024. For people who haven't been following this, Gallagher's name was being tossed around, and if Mike Gallagher, who's the congressman, represents the Green Bay area, if he had chosen to get into the race, I think he would have been the odds-on favorite to win that race. I don't think there's any question about it because Gallagher's a rising star. Mike is the real deal. There's no question about it. I have been saying for the longest time, both privately and publicly, that it just wasn't going to happen. I think, you know, Gallagher's a rising star. He's getting committee assignments he's the chairman, I think, of their China committee in the House of Representatives. Right now, the Republicans control the House of Representatives, and I think there's a decent chance that they will continue to control the House after the 2024 elections. But, he's moving up in the ranks, and he's building a larger and larger following, much like, you know, Paul Ryan did. And I think the chances of him wanting to leave that post and take what would have been a flyer. I mean, I think he would have been a very, very strong candidate. But let's face it, Tammy Baldwin is going to be a formidable opponent. I'm not saying Tammy Baldwin is going to automatically win. I think a lot depends, you know, what does 2024 look like? Does 2024 look like a wave Republican election? Does it look like a wave Democrat election? Is it going to be a split verdict like 2022 was? But Tammy Baldwin, who, you know, has been elected and reelected here in Wisconsin, she has a very, very large campaign war chest. She has an ardent national following, in part because, you know, she was the first openly gay member, openly gay female senator. And so she has a national following because of that. And while some of the things that she's done has been controversial, she's also largely been kind of a backbencher. She hasn't been up front and, you know, on the front lines of a lot of the most controversial issues. So, yes, can she be beaten? Absolutely. Is this a mortal lock? Do I consider her to be in one of the more endangered senators in the Senate? No, I don't. Not saying that she can't be beaten, and I look forward to seeing a strong conservative candidate emerge. But in the case of Mike Gallagher, he's pretty much a lock to be reelected. He likes what he does. He's, you know, working his way up through the committee process. He's getting more assignments. He's got a very, very high profile. He's on the national TV news all the time. I'm not surprised that he's made the decision not to run. I think he likes what he's doing, and he's going to stay there for the foreseeable future. In any event, he is going to be on with John McCure a little bit later this afternoon, and they are going to ask him about his take on the Trump indictment. We do live in interesting times, no doubt about that. Here's some news that kind of disappointed me. One of my favorite downtown taverns was Buck Bradley's Saloon and Eatery. It's at 1019 North King Drive, kind of Old World Third Street, right in that area. And it's one of my favorite places. We always used to do our holiday radio show. It used to originally, we do it at Turner's, And then my tradition was with some of the people, some of my friends who came to watch the show, we'd always go over to Buck Bradley's and, you know, have a cocktail or a sandwich or something after that. It's got this huge bar. I mean, it's got this long bar. And if you haven't been in there, it's really kind of a spectacular thing, sort of an old world tavern. It's closing, I think, not because it had a lack of business, but rather because the owners kind of like aged out of it, and there's some health issues and things, and a prospective buyer came along. And so Buck Bradley's is going to close. The people that are buying it are from Pete's Pub, and they're going to be opening the place under a different name. But it is kind of a Milwaukee tradition, and I hope, first of all, I wish, you know, as somebody who's whiled away over the years, many, you know, evenings and afternoons and stuff. And I loved the restaurant they had there, the pork chop sandwich, which was absolutely to kill for. I'm going to be sorry to see Buck Bradley's close, but I certainly, it's one of these things where you have to think of these places that are absolute institutions. And then what happens is, again, the owners just say, okay, well, this is the right time to move on. Nothing is forever. And it's going to be something that candidly, I think people are going to end up missing. So you've got that's going on. But that's the news. Buck Bradley's is soon going to be closing after almost 30 years as kind of a mainstay down there. And it's one of the good things is when they built Fiserv, there was a lot of concern that a lot of those bars and restaurants in that area wouldn't be able to survive the competition. And I never necessarily believed that. And I just thought, hey, some of those places are really, really good. Goolsby's is doing very, very well. Buck Bradley's doing very, very well as well. So they're closing. It's not business related. At least that's what my understanding is. And I wish the owners just all the best as they end up moving forward. Hey, something I noticed yesterday that maybe we'll do as a full-scale topic, but it's something that I think officials need to be aware of. There, you will remember a couple of years ago, we had a huge issue with what I will describe as the tent cities, you know, the homeless people who just, you know, put up tents and decide they're going to live under freeway overpasses or whatever. You have the issue with, you know, people who decide to do that at MacArthur Square and things like that. And we have this attitude that, well, you know, who cares if people end up camping out in, you know, public spaces? Well, I think that if you look at other cities that have seen what's happened with the tent cities and the homeless people who just, you know, start and decide that they can squat wherever they want, you've seen nothing but problems with regard to that, and you can't allow that to happen. So yesterday, as we were driving down to the train station, get off on the 43 north, that 43 south, and then you kind of take 794 over to get off. And I look over, and on the side of the hill between these various freeways, I see all I don't want to exaggerate. I see three or four tents that have been pitched on this slope, and there appears to be people that are just squatting there. Now, I understand this isn't like the beginning of winter or the middle of winter, but still, you've got people that are now apparently just going to these public spaces and deciding that we're going to pitch tents and we're going to live there. This should not be allowed. You're not doing people a favor by letting them live under freeway overpasses or letting them pitch tents on public spaces immediately next to the freeway on the side of the hills, etc. And this is the type of thing that quickly gets out of control. So before it gets out of control, authorities need to go out and they need to clear them out. And they need to tell people you can't be here. And if they continue to stay, then what you need to do is you need to round up the tents and take the tents away. Oh my gosh, you're taking the tents away? Yes, you are. Because letting people camp on hillsides under freeways is not doing anything for the community and it's not doing anything for the people, period.
Gather round, all. It's time for Wagner's Pop Culture Corner. Time to put aside the heavy lifting and have a good time at the old National Bank Talkin' text line at 855-616-1620. Old National Bank, get old. Now, here's Jeff Wagner.
Well, this is very cool. Our social media superstar, Dynamic Dylan, right at the start of the show, we read this very kind letter that this listener from Sheboygan sent, and he sent me this Life magazine thing on Jimmy Buffett, and we took a picture, held it up. It's all over our Twitter stuff. Very, very cool. Absolutely. You can follow us on Twitter. It's at JeffWagner620 or through our 620 Twitter account. You can also watch us as we do these shows by simply going to either our YouTube channel or the Watch Live button or the Listen Live button. Very, very cool. The picture turned out all right. That's dynamic Dylan. Okay, like the big voice guy says, this is the portion of the week where we stop talking about the indictment of Donald Trump and shared revenue and things like that, and hopefully send you into the weekend with a good mood. It's Pop Culture Corner. Sometimes we talk about food. I'm working up a topic on books. I know a number of you want me to talk about books. We're going to do that sometime. Sometimes it's sports. A lot of times it's music. Sometimes it's travel. Today's idea comes from my producer, Charlie, who actually, you know, nailed it earlier in the week. Okay, this is not Father's Day weekend, but Father's Day weekend is coming up, you know, so it's next weekend. Just, you know, remember that. And so we were talking about something related to this, and his idea, Charlie's idea was, well, let's think about, you know, dads, and let's think about dads on, you know, on television. Think about all the different TV dads that were around. And some were like good TV dads, some were bad TV dads. But who is, in recognition of Father's Day, the most memorable TV father character? And it can be drama, it can be comedy, but, you know, I guess it can be variety if you think about that. But Father's Day on television, it can be over-the-air TV, it can be streaming TV, it can be cable TV, but memorable fathers on TV, the most memorable father. Now, Pop Culture Corner is, of course, brought to you by our friends at Palermo's Pizza. And one of the things that we do is we have a Palermo's Pizza prize package. One of our callers, in the exclusive discretion of my producer, Charlie, will win our Palermo's Pizza prize package, try saying that four times fast, which includes a coupon good for two Palermo's frozen pizzas, this really cool Palermo's pizza cutter that we have, and some other stuff as well. That's exclusively in the discretion of Charlie. Our number is 855-616-1620. That is the Old National Bank talk and text line. Father's Day is coming up. The most memorable TV father. And you can decide what memorable means and then explain. 855-616-1620. Back with your texts and your calls in just a moment. It's Pop Culture Corner brought to you by Palermo's Pizza. This is Jeff Wagner.
It's Pop Culture Time. Now back to take your calls. Here's Jeff Wagner.
All right, our topic for today, Father's Day is next weekend. We are discussing the best TV father ever, the most memorable TV father ever. So, you know, again, you can decide memorable is however you want. Our number 855-616-1620, which is the Old National Bank talk and text line. Okay, let's start with Kelly and Slinger. Hi, Kelly, you're on WTMJ.
Hi, Jeff. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, ma'am. Best father ever.
This is a fun topic. Yeah, it was before my time, but Ward Cleaver from Leave It to Beaver.
Hugh Beaumont, the late, great Hugh Beaumont, who passed away. Gosh, he's been gone for a long time. 1982 is when he passed away. But yeah, he was the quintessential. He was the quintessential father, at least for Leave It to Beaver. And he was the long-suffering father who always kind of gave the advice when you thought he'd want to, like, haul off and slap one of the kids. He was always calm and things like that.
He was kind. He was understanding. But he was firm. And he also had a sense of humor. And I always thought that he was a great dad.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the interesting thing, too, his background is that he was a Methodist minister in addition to being an actor. So he was kind of the real deal as well. Died in 1982 of a heart attack. 855-616-1620. Let's talk to Carol in Milwaukee. Carol, you're on WTMJ. Good afternoon.
Hi, happy Friday.
Same to you. Okay, best, most memorable TV dad of all time.
Archie Bunker.
Okay, for good or bad or why exactly? Why would you say Carol Connor in the great role of Archie Bunker?
Just can't get him out of your head, meathead.
Yeah, thanks. It's interesting. Thanks for calling, Carol. It's interesting because, you know, Archie Bunker, who was the actor Carol Connor, was nothing like Archie Bunker in real life, nothing at all. But it was, you know, All in the Family got a lot of attention because it was groundbreaking and you had this guy who played a bigot and things like that. But at the heart, I think one of the reasons why people loved Archie Bunker so much is the fact that, you know, but underneath all the bluster, the character was somebody who loved his daughter and, you know, loved his wife and things like that. And I think that's one of the reasons why people related to him. Let's talk to Kent in Pewaukee. Kent, you're on WTMJ. Good afternoon.
Hey, Jeff. Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
Hands down, Ed O'Neill, Al Bundy. Al Bundy got to say and do what every dad was thinking.
you know, of course, married with children. Kent, it is funny when you said that, because when I was discussing this with my producer, Charlie, and I was kind of thinking, okay, if I were going to list like TV dads, and again, not from the perspective of, he certainly wasn't like, you know, Ward Cleaver, but you're right, Al Bundy was just this, you'd sit there and what was so funny is, okay, this is what so many people think about, you know, their son and their daughter and their wife and all these things. And it was just, that was groundbreaking TV in its own way as well.
Oh, yeah, it was good stuff. But you'll never see that on TV ever again.
That's true. Now, thanks to call. It's kind of like, you know, you're never going to make, you're never going to remake Blazing Saddles, the Mel Brooks movie. No question about it. Rob in Greenfield. Rob, you're on WTMJ. Good afternoon.
Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Rob.
Might be a little bit controversial moving forward now, but Heathcliff Huxtable from The Cosby Show.
Bill Cosby, yeah.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, that's the, you know, it's so funny. People just don't, I don't think people nowadays can appreciate how popular that show was, you know, and Bill Cosby as Cliff Huxtable, who was the classic example of here you have an African-American, a black man who's successful and who was funny and who had all the attributes of like Ward Cleaver and things like that. But yet, I mean, he was a role model in many cases. And then turns out that, you know, Bill Cosby, his real life kind of gets in the way of that character.
Yeah, a bit of a dirtbag, but unbelievably funny. I mean, we own DVDs of the show and had our kids. We've got kids that are like 20, 18, and 15, and
right. They
grew up watching that.
Oh,
I mean, it was a great show.
No, it was. So thanks for calling. You know, and I've said this before, I don't do interviews. That's just not what the show is all about. But over the years, I've done it. And honest to goodness, one of my very favorite interviews was Bill Cosby. You know, and it's just, he was funny, he was engaging, he played along. I say, hey, would you do Fat Albert for me? And hey, he did. And it's just, and I understand he's got this obviously other side of him that's out there and stuff. But that's that the Cosby Show just incredibly, incredibly popular. Let's talk to Bill in Manitowoc. Bill, you're on WTMJ. Good afternoon.
Got to be Gomez Adams from the Adams Family.
They're creepy and they're kooky, mysterious and spooky. Yeah,
his kids were happy. The uncle was happy. The mama was happy. You know,
absolutely. It was. I mean, thanks for calling. Now that would be Bill. That would. You're thinking out of the box. Okay. When we say most memorable fathers, you know, Gomez Adams wouldn't necessarily come to mind. But yes, you know, you had the Adams Family. I remember when that was on TV. I'm old enough to remember the Adams Family, and it was on TV at the same time of the Munsters, and I was expecting somebody to call in and say Herman Munster. We haven't had that yet. Here's a couple texts. Jeff, has to be Homer Simpson. I grew up with him. When I was younger, I thought he was the idiot father. Now that I'm older and a couple of children of my own, I can relate. I tried to call in. All the lines are busy. Yeah, and Robert Young, Father Knows Best. Yeah, a lot of people are mentioning that. That's an older TV show. That was actually even before my time. But Robert Young, I remember that from there. Jeff, Chuck Connors in The Rifleman as... Right, who played Lucas. I forget what the last name was, but you're right, that was The Rifleman. Number of people are mentioning Howard Cunningham on Happy Days, Tom Bosley, who played that. Yeah, that would be a good choice as well. I would say we have a lot of those as well. Okay, let's talk to Dave in Brookfield. Dave, you're on WTMJ. Good afternoon.
Hey, Jeff. Love your show.
Thanks.
I would go with Sheriff Taylor, Andy Griffith. I thought he's the consummate father to Opie.
Yeah. Ding, 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 ding. You, Dave, are the winner of our Palermo's Pizza prize package, and you are a spokesperson for a huge chunk of our audience, because I would say about 50% of the texts, and we're getting swamped with texts, everybody mentions Sheriff Taylor, Andy Griffith, who, you know, was... He was the great father in raising Opie and always patient and things like that. Patient with Barney, yeah. Patient with Aunt B, all those things. Do you still watch that show?
Yeah, occasionally. I mean, it's on a lot of the other networks, you know, on cable and so on, and it's just always relaxing to watch it. And if I could just tell you my favorite episode.
Oh, sure.
They were going to go to a ball game up at Mount Pilot, and Opie lost his new watch. And Andy said, "You can't go until you find the watch." Well, all week long, he couldn't find it. So Andy actually went out and bought an identical watch and put it in his sock drawer, and then Opie, quote, found it. Well, they get to the game. Opie goes to put his hand in his glove, you know, to catch fly balls or foul right. balls, and there was the other watch. And he pulled it out. He said, "Dad, what?" You know, he's all confused. And Andy just, you know, it's the end of the show. It's the best. So, now he's got two watches, and Andy has no way to explain it.
I know. You know, it's funny you mention that, because okay, I have two friends. I have many more than two friends, I like to think, but my friends Joe and Janet, they, you know, I forget what channel, like at 5 o'clock or at 6 o'clock at night, you know, they'll show like three or four shows of the Andy Griffith Show. And, you know, sometimes when we're trying to make arrangements, "Hey, you want to go meet us for dinner?" It's kind of like, "Well, I don't know. We're going to watch Andy Griffith." They've seen all the shows time after time. They can do all the lines, but it never stops them from being amused with that. And yeah, that it is a tremendous show. Okay, let's talk to Melissa in Cedarburg. Melissa, you're on WTMJ. Who would you nominate for the most memorable father?
Andy Griffith, just like everybody else. Why not?
Why not? Do you still watch the shows? Do you still ever see them?
I do.
Yeah.
I do. I see them often on MeTV.
MeTV, that's it. Yep, MeTV, right. That's it.
MeTV.
You never get tired of watching. Yeah. Even if you've seen the episodes 15 times,
never.
You still like them. Yeah. That's the great thing.
Yeah.
No, thanks for that. That's the great thing about that show. Okay, here's my like obscure detail about the Andy Griffith Show. The woman who played Helen Crump, in real life, she was kind of a free spirit in the 1960s, and she had a torrid extramarital affair with Andy Griffith, you know, so they were an item off screen as well, and he was married at the time. We got so many great texts here. Red Foreman from the 70s show, that's a good one. Number of people are mentioning that. Bill Bixby from The Courtship of Eddie's Father. Mike Brady, Father of the Year. Jeff, Michael Landon, that would be Little House on the Prairie. Jeff, for me, it was Fred Sanford from Sanford and Son. Yeah, you've got that as well. A lot of people with Andy Griffith, Jim Anderson from Father Knows Best. Yeah, that was the Robert Young character. Lots of votes for Ward Cleaver as well. Oh, Fred McMurray, the old My Three Sons show. Yeah, that was a good one as well. He was great. There's no question about it. For me, Jeff, it's Robin Williams and Mr. Mom. Well, that's not TV. Ben Cartwright, right? Lauren Green from The Ponderosa. He went on to be on one of the, not Battlestar Galactica, but one of the other ones. Jeff, for me, the father was Ricky Ricardo, Desi Arnaz from I Love Lucy. I don't know. No question about it. Lots for Ward Cleaver. Uncle Jesse from Dukes of Hazzard. Well, we're going to kind of going back there as well. Uncle Phil from the French Fresh Prince of Bel Air. Got that one as well. A lot of votes from Mike Brady. So you got to love that. Got to be Walter White from Breaking Bad. That's Karen in Franksville. Well, most memorable TV dad. Walter White was definitely memorable. Oh, matter of fact, Bryan Cranston, who plays him, he's announced that he's going to retire from acting 2 years from now. He said, after 2026, I'm going to be 70. I'm going to give it up. We will see. Okay, I'm just about out of time. Thanks for all the calls. Thanks for all the texts. And you all have great ideas. And so one of the reasons I want to do it a week before Father's Day is give you a chance to say, I was listening to that show. And yeah, just in recognition of fathers, let's fire up the Andy Griffith Show, or let's fire up, you know, The Simpsons, or let's fire up, you know, whatever, and watch them and enjoy some of the great fathers that are out there. We'll do more Father's Day related stuff as we get closer to next weekend. But that's Pop Culture Corner for today. Thank you for participating.